Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. During the last show, we ended up discussing hedge funds and derivatives. Derivatives and the hedge funds that specialize in them have been called merely a disguise, something designed to look different enough from the last time so no one realizes what is happening. John Train, writing in the Financial Times, used this colorful analogy, quote, "It's like the floor show in a seedy nightclub. A sequence of girls trot on the scene, first a collection of Apaches, then some ballerinas, then cowgirls, and so forth. After a while, the bemused spectator realizes that in all cases, they were the same girls in slightly different costumes. The so-called hedge fund actually was an excuse for a margin account." And that's the end of the quote. Hedge funds are private funds that pool the assets of wealthy investors with the aim of making absolute returns, making a profit whether the market goes up or down. To maximize their profits, they typically use credit borrowed against the fund's assets to leverage their investments. Leverage is the use of borrowed funds to increase purchasing power. The greater the leverage, the greater the possible gain or loss. In futures trading, This leverage is called the margin. Leveraging on margin, or by borrowing money, allows investors to place many more bets than if they had paid the full price. In the 1920s, wealthy investors engaged in pooling, combining their assets to influence the markets for their collective benefit. Like trusts and monopolies, pooling was considered to be a form of collusive interference with the normal market forces of supply and demand. Hedge funds are the modern-day variants of this scheme. They are usually run in offshore banking centers, such as the Cayman Islands, to avoid regulation. Offshore funds are exempt from margin requirements that restrict trading on credit, and from uptick rules that limit short sales to assets that are rising in price. Hedge funds were originally set up to hedge the bets of investors, insuring against currency or interest rate fluctuations, but they quickly became instruments of manipulation and control. Many of the largest hedge funds are run by former bank or investment bank dealers who have left with the blessings of their former employers. The bank's investment money is then placed with the hedge funds, which can operate in a more unregulated environment than the banks can themselves. By 2005, hedge funds were often responsible for over half the daily trading in the equity market due to their huge size and the huge amounts of capital funding them. That gave them an enormous amount of control over what the markets would do. In the fall of 2006, 8,282 of the 9,800 hedge funds operating worldwide were registered in the Cayman Islands, a British overseas territory with a population of 57,000 people. The Cayman Islands Monetary Authority gives each hedge fund at registration a 100-year exemption from any taxes, shelters the fund's activity behind a wall of official secrecy, allows the fund to self-regulate, and prevents other nations from regulating the funds. Derivatives are key investment tools of hedge funds. Derivatives are basically side bets that some underlying investment, a stock, commodity, market, etc., will go up or down. They are not really investments because they don't involve the purchase of an asset. They are outside bets on what the asset will do. All derivatives are variations on futures trading, and all futures trading is inherently speculation or gambling. The more familiar types of derivatives include puts, betting the asset will go down, and calls, betting the asset will go up. Over 90% of the derivatives held by banks today, however, are over-the-counter derivatives, investment devices specially tailored to financial institutions, often having exotic and complex features, not traded on standard exchanges. They are not regulated, are hard to trace, and are very hard to understand. Some critics say they are impossible to understand because they were designed to be so complex and obscure as to mislead investors. At one time, tough rules regulated speculation of this sort. The Glass-Steagall Act, passed during the New Deal, separated commercial banking from securities trading, and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, was created in 1974 to regulate commodity futures and option markets and to protect market participants from price manipulation, abusive sales practices, and fraud. But again, the speculators have managed to get around the rules. Derivative traders claim they are not dealing in securities or futures because nothing is being traded. And just to make sure, they induced Congress to empower the head of the CFTC to grant waivers to that effect. And they set up offshore hedge funds that remained small, unregistered, and unregulated. They also had the Glass-Steagall Act repealed. And I'll be back in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So back to derivatives. In a 1998 interview, banking columnist John Hoeffel clarified the derivatives phenomenon with this colorful analogy. Quote, during the 1980s, you had the creation of a huge financial bubble. You could look at that as fleas who set up a trading empire on a dog. They start pumping more and more blood out of the dog to support their trading. And then at a certain point, the amount of blood that they're trading exceeds what they can pump from the dog without killing the dog. The dog begins to get very sick. So being clever little critters, what they do is they switch to trading in blood futures. And since there's no connection, they break the connection between the blood available and the amount you can trade. Then you can have a real explosion of trading. And that's what the derivatives market represents. And so now you've had this explosion of trading in blood futures, which is going right up to the point that now the dog is on the verge of dying. And that's essentially what the derivatives market is. It's the last gasp of a financial bubble. End quote. What has broken the connection between the blood available and the amount you can trade is that derivatives are not assets. They are just bets on what the asset will do, and the bet can be placed with very little real money down. Most of the money is borrowed from banks that create it on a computer screen as it is lent. The connection with reality has been severed so completely that the market for over-the-counter derivatives has now reached many times the money supply of the world. Since these private bets are unreported and unregulated, nobody knows exactly how much money is riding on them. However, the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, reported that in the first half of 2006, the notational value of derivative trades has soared to a record $370 trillion. And by December 2007, the figure was up to a breathtaking $681 trillion. The notational value of a derivative is a hypothetical number described as the number of units of an asset underlying the contract multiplied by the spot price of the asset. Synonyms for notational include fanciful, not based on fact, dubious, imaginary. Just how fanciful these values are is evident from the numbers. $681 trillion is over 50 times the $13 trillion gross domestic product of the U.S. economy. In 2006, the total gross domestic product, GDP, of the world was only $66 trillion, one-tenth the notational value of the derivative trade in 2007. In a September 2006 article in MarketWatch, Thomas Costigan wrote, quote, "It's worth wondering how so much extra value can be squeezed out of instruments that are essentially fake. Wall Street manufactures these products and trades them in a rather shadowy way that keeps the average investor in the dark. You cannot exactly look up the price of an equity derivative in your daily newspaper stock table. It wouldn't take all that much to create a domino effect of market mishap. And there is no net. The Securities Investor Protection Corporation, which insures brokerage accounts in the event of a brokerage firm failure, recently announced its reserves. It had about $1.38 billion. That may sound like a lot. Compared with half a quadrillion, it's a pittance. Scary, but true." End of quote. How are these astronomical sums even possible? The answer again is that derivatives are just bets, and gamblers can bet any amount they want. Gary Novak is a scientist with a website devoted to simplifying complex issues. He writes, quote, "It's like two persons flipping a coin for $1 trillion, and afterwards someone owes $1 trillion, which never existed," end quote. He calls it funny money. Like the Mississippi bubble, the derivatives bubble is built on something that doesn't really exist. And when the losers cannot afford to pay up their future bets, the scheme must collapse. Either that, or the taxpayers will be saddled with the bill for the largest bailout in history. In a report presented at the request of the House Committee on Banking, Finance, and Urban Affairs in 1994, Christopher White used some other vivid imagery for a derivatives affliction. He wrote, "The derivatives market is the greatest bubble in history. It dwarfs the Mississippi bubble in France and the South Sea Island bubble in England. This bubble, like a cancer, has penetrated and taken over the entirety of our banking and credit system. There is no major commercial bank, investment bank, mutual fund, etc., that is not dependent on derivatives for its existence. These derivatives suck the life's blood out of our economy. Our farms, our factories, our nation's infrastructure, our living standards are being sucked dry to pay off interest payments, dividend yields, as well as other earnings on the bubble." End of the quote. How speculation in derivatives draws much needed capital away from domestic productivity was explained by White with another analogy. Quote, "It would be like going to the horse races to bet, but not on the race, on the size of the pot. Who would care about what's involved with getting the runners to the starting gate?" End quote. Since the gamblers don't care who wins, they aren't interested in feeding the horses or hiring stable hands. They are only interested in money making money. Today, more money can be had at less risk by speculation in derivatives than by investing in the growth of a business. And this is particularly true if you are a very big bank with the ability to influence the way the bet goes. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency reported that in mid-2006, there were close to 9,000 commercial and savings banks in the United States, yet 97% of U.S. bank-held derivatives were concentrated in the hands of just 5 banks. Topping the list were JPMorgan Chase and Citibank, the citadels of the Morgan and Rockefeller empires. Now let's take a look at the concept called derivative wars. The seismic power of the new derivative weapons was demonstrated in 1992 when George Soros and his giant hedge fund, Quantum Group, backed by Citibank and other powerful institutional speculators, used derivatives to collapse the currencies of Great Britain and Italy in a single day. The European monetary system was taken down with them. According to White, quote, "They showed that day that the speculative cancer that had been unleashed had grown beyond the point that monetary authorities could control. Farmers who have been ruined by short sellers on commodities markets know what this is all about, selling what you do not own in order to buy it back later for less. These are instruments of financial warfare deployed against nations and the populations in much the same way the commodity market short seller has been deployed to bankrupt the farmer." End quote. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the European debacle. More than $60 billion were poured into the 1992 onslaught against European currencies, and this money was largely borrowed from giant international banks. A 1997 report by an IMF research team confirmed that to fuel a speculative attack, hedge funds needed the backing of the banks, since few private parties were willing or able to make those very large and risky investments. By 1997, the hedge funds had an estimated $100 billion in assets, which could be leveraged 5 to 10 times, giving them up to $1 trillion in battering power. An article in The Economist observed, quote, "That may sound a lot, particularly if hedge funds leverage their capital, but consider that the assets of rich country institutional investors exceed $20 trillion. Hedge funds are bit players compared with banks, mutual or pension funds, many of which engage in exactly the same types of speculation," end quote. George Soros raised this defense himself when his giant hedge fund was blamed for the Asian currency crisis of 1997-98. In The Crisis of Global Capitalism, he wrote, quote, "There has been much discussion of the role of hedge funds in destabilizing the financial system. I believe the discussion is misdirected. Hedge funds are not the only ones to use leverage. The proprietary trading desks of commercial and investment banks are the main players in derivatives and swaps. Hedge funds, as a group, did not equal in size the proprietary trading desks of bankers and brokers," end quote. Between 1996 and 2005, the number of hedge funds more than doubled, and their capital grew from $200 billion to over $1 trillion. Between 1987 and 2005, derivatives, betting on international interest rate and currencies grew from $865 billion to $201.4 trillion. This explosion in derivative bets was matched on the downside by an explosion in risk. When a megacorporation or a debtor nation goes bankrupt, the banks that are derivatively hedging its bets can go bankrupt too. When Russia defaulted on its debts, LTCM went bankrupt and threatened to take the banks with interlocking investments down with it. A November 2005 Bloomberg report warned, quote, "The $12.4 trillion market for credit derivatives is dominated by too few banks, making it vulnerable to a crisis if one of them fails to pay on contracts that insure creditors from companies defaulting. JP Morgan Chase & Company, Deutsche Bank AG, Goldman Sachs Group, and Morgan Stanley are the most frequent traders in a market where the top 10 firms account for more than two-thirds of the debt insurance contracts bought and sold," end quote. John Hoeffel warned in 2005 that the dog has already run out of blood. He wrote, quote, "We are on the verge of the biggest financial blowout in centuries, bigger than the Great Depression, bigger than the South Sea bubble, bigger than the tulip bubble. The derivatives bubble, in which Citicorp, Morgan, and the other big New York banks are unsalvageably overexposed, is about to pop. The currency warfare operations of the Fed, George Soros, and Citigroup have generated billions of dollars in profits, but they have destroyed the financial system in the process. The fleas have killed a dog, and thus they have killed themselves," end of quote. But you might ask, how can a bank go bankrupt? Don't they have the power to create money out of thin air, as we've been discussing? Why doesn't a bank with bad loans on its books just write them off and carry on? British economist Michael Robotham explains that under the accountancy rules of commercial banks, all banks are obliged to balance their books, making their assets equal their liabilities. They can create all the money they can find borrowers for, but if the money isn't paid back, the banks have to record a loss, and when they cancel or write off debt, their total assets fall. To balance their books by making their assets equal their liabilities, they have to take money either from profits or from funds invested by the bank's owners. And if the loss is more than the bank or its owners can profitably sustain, the bank will have to close its doors. Before 1988, U.S. banks were restricted in the amount of money they could create only by the reserve requirement, but the rule got whittled down and banks figured out how to get around it. the Bank for International Settlements, the Central Bankers Central Bank in Basel, Switzerland, then came up with a new set of rules. No longer would reserves in the form of other people's deposits be the only cap on money creation. The Basel Committee on Banking Supervision published a set of minimal capital adequacy requirements called Basel I. The committee said that loans had to be classified according to risk and that the banks had to maintain capital, money of their own, not just their depositors, roughly equal to 8% of these risk-weighted assets. Bank capital is the money paid in by investors plus accumulated retained earnings. It is the net worth of the bank, or assets minus liabilities. How the capital requirement is determined is even more complicated than the reserve requirement, but here is a simplified version. Under Basel I, assets are risk-weighted, with some being considered riskier than others. Ordinary loans have a risk weighting of 1. The capital adequacy rule requires that the ratio of the bank's capital to its assets with the risk weighting of 1 be at least 8%. That means the bank must have $8 in capital for every $100 in ordinary loans. Federal bonds have a risk weighting of 0. They are considered to be as safe as dollars and don't need any extra capital backing them. Mortgage loans, which are secured by real estate, have a risk weighting of 0.5. That means they need only $4 of capital for every $100 of loans. Other bank exposures given risk weightings include such things as derivatives and foreign exchange contracts. When a bank cannot meet its capital requirement, it cannot make new loans. It is a zombie bank. And when old loans default, the asset side of the bank's balance sheet shrinks until the bank is propelled into bankruptcy. Banks are clearly taking a risk when they extend credit, so bankers will argue that they deserve the interest they get on these loans, even if they did conjure the money out of thin air. Somebody has to create the national money supply. Why not private bankers? What is wrong with the banking system as it is? One problem with the current system is that the government itself has been seduced into borrowing money created out of nothing and paying interest on it, when the government could have created the funds itself, debt and interest free. In the case of government loans, the banks take virtually no risk, since the government is always good for the interest, and the taxpayer gets saddled with a crippling debt that could have been avoided. Another problem with the fractional reserve system is simply in the math. Since all money except coins comes into existence as a debt to private banks, and the banks create only the principal when they make loans, there is never enough money in the economy to repay principal plus interest on the nation's collective debt. When the money supply was tethered to gold, this problem was resolved through periodic waves of depression and default that wiped the slate clean and started the cycle all over again. Although it was a brutal system for the farmers and laborers who got wiped out, and it allowed a financier class to get progressively richer while the actual producers got poorer, it did succeed in lending a certain stability to the money supply. Today, however, the Fed has taken on the task of preventing depressions, something it does by pumping more and more credit money into the economy by funding a massive federal debt that no one ever expects to have to repay, and this credit money is advanced at interest. At some point, the interest bill alone must exceed the taxpayer's ability to pay it, and that day of reckoning may not be far off. We may soon be at the point where we will have to consider some sort of paradigm shift if the economy is to survive. And I will continue in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.